I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Over 75 years after he abdicated the British throne for the woman he loved, and just over 25 years since her death, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor remained a source of fascination, intrigue, and speculation. There was the recent Madonna offering W.E., which brought the Windsors into a cinematic light. Also, a new book brings the legend and myth surrounding Edward VIII and his American-born divorcee wife Wallis Simpson back to life for a new reassessment. The book is called That Woman, The Life of Wallis Simpson, Duchess of Windsor, and its author is a celebrated biographer, Anne Seba. She has written a highly readable, fascinating book whose title is taken from the late Queen Mother, who used to refer to Wallis as that woman. One likely saw a bit of the Queen Mother's dislike for the Windsors in the Oscar-winning film The King's Speech. In the book, Ms. Seba, who joins me from Chicago this day, skillfully navigates through the voluminous history inspired by the Windsors. As well, she presents newly discovered letters that further illuminate the romance of the Duke and Duchess, that perhaps it wasn't all that it was cracked up to be, that perhaps Wallis was still very much in love with her second husband, Ernest Simpson, and in fact had been manipulated by a petty, childish king into marrying him. Was theirs truly the romance of the 20th century? What inspired their unique style? We'll ask Anne Seba that and more. The book is published by St. Martin's Press, and the author's website is at anneseba.com. I'm very pleased to welcome to the Plant Online program Anne Seba. Ms. Seba, good morning.
Hello, lovely to speak to you.
And the same, the same. So congratulations on a very fine book. What was your goal in writing about Wallis Simpson? Did you want to rehabilitate her image, perhaps?
No, that was absolutely not my purpose at all at the outset. However, I started this in 2007, just after I'd finished a biography of Jenny Churchill, another American who was much reviled by the establishment and misunderstood. And I remember saying to my agent, you know, the woman who's really had a rough deal from the British establishment is Wallis Simpson. And I said, I'd love to write about her, but I just don't want to if there's nothing new. So I really didn't know, but I suspected there would be, because the Queen Mother, who you referred to, Queen Elizabeth, married to George VI, had always hated Wallis and never lost an opportunity to refer to her as a Nazi and the lowest of the low. Well, clearly she wasn't the lowest of the low. And I just figured after the Queen Mother's death in 2002, there were probably new papers being released and that there must be a new version of this story, although I didn't know what it would be. But I couldn't believe that any one woman could be all the things she was accused of being, you know, Nazi whore, prostitute, spy, gold digger. Okay, so she could be some, but probably not all. And I figured that 75 years after the abdication was a really good time to look again at the story, because 100 years is too late, everybody's gone and dead. But 75 years, there are still people who remember these events. So my hunch was proved correct, but when I started, it really was just a hunch.
And so in the course of writing the book, you find these letters. These are letters that Wallis had written to Ernest Simpson, I guess, just before she married the Duke, right?
Well, it was after her divorce, really, in 36 when they started. Right. And it was just dynamite for a biographer. I mean, it's what we all hope and dream of finding, a bundle of 15 letters tied up with a ribbon, still in their envelopes and postmark. And once I'd found those, there were actually more letters and documents and diaries and cuttings. It's an extraordinary, well, treasure trove. But the reason it's so important is merely writing these letters in 1936, Wallis risked setting this complex two-stage divorce process at naught. She reckoned she risked having the whole divorce thing leaving her in a limbo, because British divorce, I don't want to go into a history lesson, but it was two-stage. You could get the decree nisi, and then if anyone suspected that actually material facts had not been put before the court, they could complain, which is what happened in her case, and you'd be left in this sort of limbo where you were no longer married to the husband you were trying to divorce, but nor were you free to marry anyone else. In spite of that very real threat, Wallis was writing to Ernest, the husband she was meant to hate, the husband she was accusing of adultery, all of that. And it was a highly risky strategy, but she felt so alone, and there was no one else she could write to. The king really did not have the emotional sensitivity to help her, and if it was known that the king was involved in the divorce, then, you know, again, it should not have been allowed to go ahead. So no wonder the Archbishop of Canterbury, Cosmo Gordon Lang, a man also who's always been reviled, didn't really relish the idea of a coronation of a king who was meant to promise to uphold the law of the land, when here was a king who was actually subverting the law of the land. So that's why these letters, you know, really are dynamite. They show that not only did Wallis really not want to go ahead with this wedding to a man that she privately called Peter Pan. She and Ernest had this nickname for Edward, the man who history has always said, you know, here's a king who's given up everything. He's given up his throne. He's given up his empire because of this great love. And in these letters, you find that Wallis didn't share the same great love for Edward. She called him Peter Pan, the boy who wouldn't grow up. So she and Ernest recognized that he was a boy at heart. He wasn't really an adult, a damaged adolescent at best. And also they show that actually she loved her second husband, Ernest Simpson. Now, I don't want to say this was the great love of her life, but it was really a love, a comfortable love. She looked on Ernest as a father figure. And too late, she recognized what she was giving up. She and Ernest used this word congenial. They got along so well together. They were comfortable. And, you know, the sad thing is it reveals that they were in this together. They were social climbers. They were ambitious. And, you know, the moral of the story really is be careful what you wish for. If you play with fire, you get burnt. And Wallis got burned big time.
Now, the letters that you saw, were there letters after the Duchess and the Duke of Windsor got married and up to his death?
No, not really. That they stopped in 38. I mean, that's quite late. Wallis right. was writing to Ernest even on her honeymoon in Germany. I mean, how bizarre is that? But after 38, when she recognized that she really had not only saddled herself with the ex-king, now the Duke of Windsor, for life, but she recognized that she had lost Ernest forever because Ernest married Mary Kirk. Now, Mary Kirk was Wallace's best friend from school, a young girl or woman by that stage who Wallis had manipulated into coming over from America to keep Ernest company so that she could go out with the king as he then was. She thought that Mary would entertain Ernest, and then when it was all over and she, Wallis, was dumped, that she'd go back to Ernest and lead a comfortable life with a few jewels, a few memories. But it didn't work out like that, not only because the king threatened suicide, he wasn't prepared to let Wallis go, but also Ernest fell in love with Mary. So I describe it as a sort of double pincer movement, which Wallis was slow to recognize. She'd lost Ernest, and there was no getting out of marriage to the king, or ex-king, as he, of course, was.
Yeah, no, you know, you mentioned that both Ernest and Wallis were social climbers. Just about Wallis, I guess the poverty that she grew up in Baltimore, that really affected her life, and that really, I guess, it drove her, didn't it?
Yes. I think Wallis remains hard to like. I mean, she would have been fun, goodness me, to go out for lunch with a bunch of girlfriends. You'd come back and you'd say, oh, we had such a great time. Wallis is so funny. Yeah. We gossiped about this. You know, at that level, she really was easy to like. She was sharp, quick-witted, funny. And that, of course, was one of the things that attracted the king in the first place, or Prince of Wales, as he was when they were presented at court in 1931. But I think you have to understand her circumstances. And that, to me, was the driving force of her relationship. She grew up in relative poverty, an outsider in a rich family. The two families in Baltimore, her father's family, the Warfields, her mother's, the Montagues, they were both the elite in Baltimore terms. So the fact that her father died when she was just a few months old, leaving her mother, Alice Montague, or Alice Warfield, as she became, really exposed, I think that was the damaging factor that really burned deep in her psyche. They depended on the charity of her father's brother, Uncle Sol, Solomon Warfield, and he was really cruelly controlling. Sometimes there was a lot of money, sometimes there was nothing. He wouldn't pay for a coming-out ball for Wallace, and she felt without a coming-out ball she stood no chance of marrying well. So she always felt an outsider. Her mother had to sell embroidery to the local craft exchange. She tried a restaurant, and that didn't work. Her mother really tried to be independent, but never had enough money. And feeling an outsider in the Warfield family was damaging to Wallace. So, yes, I do think this need for security, this need to know she'd always have money, she'd never be as poor as her mother, was a driving force. And I also think that the relationship between Wallace and her mother was one of the really affecting, genuine relationships in the whole story. Wallace wanted to avenge her mother's poverty, and I think that was really a driving force in taking up with the prince in the first place.
Now, in all romances and all love stories, sex, I guess, features prominently. in between her two marriages to Mr. Spencer and then Mr. Simpson, she goes to China, and there was much speculation, rumors about what she did there and sort of what she learned there. There was one rumor that she'd learned some sort of sexual technique that helped her later on seduce the then Prince of Wales. What have you found out about why she went there and what she did there in China? And I guess it would have been the mid-20s.
Well, I've followed in her footsteps. I've been to Shanghai and Peking because, you know, this China dossier, which her mother-in-law, Queen Mary, and Prime Minister Baldwin were alleged to have compiled, has attracted biographers like me forever. Mm-hmm. It's said to give details of the China clinch, the Baltimore grip, and the Shanghai squeeze. So I'm sure you can imagine I was very keen to try and find this dossier.
Right.
I don't think it exists. I think it's all part of a misinformation campaign. But although that might not exist, Wallace went to China in 1924 to 25 to try, initially, to try and patch up the marriage to Wynne Spencer, because getting a divorce was pretty shocking. Her uncle wasn't prepared to fund her if she got a divorce. So she tried to patch up the marriage. It didn't work. He obviously was alcoholic and violent, and the marriage really was never going to work. But she stayed on in China, even when she knew she couldn't get a divorce. She'd hoped there'd be an American court in Shanghai, and she could get a cheap American divorce. That didn't work. She stayed on, and clearly, this is the source of the problem, she was able to lead a sexually liberated life, which in 1924 to 25 was not an option available to most women. Birth control did not exist or barely existed, and worst of all was the fear of abortion, which was difficult, if not dangerous, and illegal. And yet, Wallace writes in her memoirs that life was so good, almost too good for a woman. What did she mean by that? Well, I think she meant she was able to lead a sexually liberated life without fear of getting pregnant. How did she do it? Well, either she was born with some sort of disorder of sexual development, which meant she didn't have a womb or a fully functioning womb or a faulty cervix. One will never know, short of exhuming the body and doing DNA. Or an alternative possibility, her husband had given her syphilis, which had rendered her infertile. Either way, I have discovered she had a medical problem, and she sought help in Shanghai. I don't know what it was, but whatever it was meant that she was able to have relationships with men without fear of getting pregnant. And I think that's very interesting. And clearly, she learnt ways of pleasing a man. And as we all know, in 2012, there are many ways for a woman to please a man. And by honing her technique, that obviously gave rise to this China dossier. I actually think her technique, in some ways, was not sexual. I think she was able to make a man feel. She would study everything of interest to a man before meeting him and then regurgitate this and establish eye contact, and it made the man feel absolutely wonderful that he was the center of the universe. And all of this is not necessarily sexual. I mean, it can have sexual elements to it, but I think ultimately the relationship with the Prince of Wales was psychosexual. I think he was looking for a mother figure. He was looking for somebody to dominate him, somebody to be in control. And the fact that Wallace offered this, as well as all the other attendant abilities to please a man, I think was very seductive for him. I think he was, as I've said, damaged. I think he knew at some deep subliminal level he didn't want the throne, that he was inadequate, that he could never do his duty in the way that his father, the very macho George V, did his duty. And quite possibly he too was sterile. And I think that's the ultimate failure for an heir to the throne, not to be able to produce his own heir. So I think Wallace offered him all sorts of attractions that ultimately he couldn't refuse. And he didn't want to be king, so by marrying Wallace, it was the perfect way to escape his destiny. And I also think that he hoped by marrying her, he could then come back to England and not be king, but have all the pleasures of an ex-king without any of the responsibility. Well, as you'll all know from the King's speech, there was no way Queen Elizabeth and George VI were going to allow this man who'd given up on his duty to come back and live in England as an ex-king with all the pleasures and none of the responsibility.
There were some rumors that she was a hermaphrodite. Now, what have you concluded with regards to that?
I've concluded that one will never know, but of course I had to deal with it because it was out there in the open. But as I've said, I do think it's quite possible she could have, I don't think she was a hermaphrodite, but I do think she could have some disorder of sexual development, which is not rare, it's quite common, and it's a sort of umbrella for all sorts of possibilities, because, as I've said, we do know, the one fact we do know is that she couldn't have children. Yeah. I've tried to look into it by discussing it with psychiatrists and psychologists, and it fits the personality type. Someone who knows they can't have children, which is the ultimate way to confirm your femininity. You need to tell the world, I may not be able to have children, but hey, I'm the most feminine thing you've ever seen. And you do that by outrageous flirting and by wearing clothes that are also pretty eye-catching and that tell the world, you know, I'm available, I'm a woman, and I'm attractive as a woman. And those things certainly Wallace was great at doing. She flirted outrageously and needed always to have a man in tow. So it fits the personality type, but it can only be conjecture. So, you know, as a historian, I don't really like going down that route. On the other hand, as a biographer, I love exploring what makes people tick. That's what the whole thing's about.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned her sense of style, her dress. She dressed well and captured attention despite not being what one would consider a strikingly beautiful woman. What inspired her in terms of the style that's you know, legend now, that's famous, the style that both the Duke and Duchess had?
Classic. I think I would just pick you up on one of those things. She's not classically beautiful in the sort of English rose sense of, you know, blonde blue eyes, pink skin and all of that. I actually think she was very strikingly elegant with beautiful eyes, and that part of this is what I call the misinformation campaign. You know, nobody could be prepared to admit that actually she was possibly even beautiful, certainly elegant and striking. So what inspired her style? Well, I think making the best of those features. So she didn't always get it right. Mostly she did, and she needed plain, elegant, well-cut clothes which could show off a fabulous, big, large, brash piece of jewelry. That was one of the things. I think she used clothes to convey another message. look at me, she was saying. Look what an elegant, chic woman you'd have had as queen if you'd had me, instead of that rather frumpy woman, her nemesis, who wears flowery hats. I think she wanted the English to feel they'd actually missed out on a style icon as queen. So she used clothes and jewelry to convey a message that she was the most elegant person, and look what an elegant queen they might have had if they'd had her.
After the Duke dies in 72, she becomes a recluse and spends sort of the last decade of her life hidden. Do you think she was happy at all in the course of her life? Did she love David, essentially?
I can only go by what everyone tells me who knew them, because she was very correct, she was very loyal. You know, she didn't give up on her duty, and her duty was to create what I call a mini kingdom of style, to give him the closest thing he could have to a palace without a palace. But happy is a word I wouldn't use about her. No, I don't believe she was happy. I believe she spent her days in a rather empty, superficial way, buying clothes and jewelry, organizing dinner parties. What did she have to make her happy? There's a very telling interview with them both at the end of their lives, where the interviewer asks them, do they have any regrets? And she immediately says, you know, touching her bouffant hairstyle, oh, yes, of course, you know, regrets, who doesn't? But, you know, they're nothing. The body language says it all. And he, David, as she called him, immediately reaches out and grasps her hand and says, oh, well, you know, regrets, but we've been very happy, darling, haven't we? With that sort of sad puppy dog expression he had, holding her hand and looking into her eyes. I think for him, it was wonderful to have her everywhere, but I don't believe she was happy. And people who saw them together talk of how rude and cruel and humiliating she often was. And for some reason, he seemed to lap up this form of punishment, almost as if he felt he needed to be punished for giving up on his duty. And why did he need to be punished, and what did he get out of it? Well, again, if you talk to psychiatrists about this sort of relationship, they will all say, because the moment of forgiveness, when she forgave him privately, perhaps in the bedroom, was sublime. He craved that moment of forgiveness.
I just noticed that you mentioned you'd written a book on Jenny Churchill, and now the Duchess of Windsor. Ralph Martin, he did 2 volumes on Churchill, and he also wrote a book on Churchill. Do you think there's similarities between the two, other than that they were American and reviled? Or
not really?
No,
I think they were very different. I think Jenny was actually a deeply sexual being in a very open and upfront way that women today can relate to. Actually, I think she is quite different. I think she was motherly and maternal in a way that not many mothers are, because she really saw a spark in Winston and nurtured that spark and desperately wanted him to succeed. So she lived her life vicariously, initially through her husband Randolph, whom she hoped would make it, and when he didn't, immediately picked up the burden and placed it on Winston's shoulders and lived vicariously through him. But she also was a very talented, clever woman. She became a newspaper editor, a journal editor. She wrote plays. She became an interior designer. She had, and she was a concert pianist. She practiced 5 hours a day. She had many, many talents. She was just born in the wrong era, where it wasn't acceptable for a woman to work, and she'd been brought up as almost a dollar princess, where her father, Leonard Jerome, expected her to make a grand marriage and to be looked after by a man. And the great disappointment of her life was that Randolph died of syphilis and did not provide for her. So late in the day, she turned to all her multiple talents and tried to make things work for herself. None of them brought her in any money until her final project being an interior decorator, and then she died age 67 falling down the stairs. So no, I really don't think there are many similarities other than being misunderstood.
And being written about by Mr. Martin and yourself. You talked to Madonna in the course of her making her movie, and she told you that she liked Wallace. As a biographer, what have you concluded in terms of where you are and how you feel about Wallace Simpson?
Oh, I don't identify with her in the way. Madonna really identifies with her as an American woman misunderstood by the establishment. And I'm sure they're both style icons as well, and both terribly famous. So I can absolutely recognize that she would identify in a way that I absolutely don't identify. I think it's important, not for a biographer, to like your subject. Perhaps it helps. I did like Jenny, and I did admire Jenny. My attitude to Wallace is rather different. I think she deserves to be understood. She still remains hard to like. What I always say is I'd love to go out for lunch with her, and I'd enjoy her company. I wouldn't ask Wallace home to meet my husband. I think I'd draw the line there.
The book was a bestseller in England. Do you think that the perception of Mrs. Simpson, the Duchess of Windsor, do you think that's changed in Britain?
Yes, I do think it's changed in England a little bit. I think there's a different attitude here in the U.S. I think, on the one hand, they're prouder of her as an American woman. You know, local girl does well. Local girl made art well. And you can see that, actually. They feel that she needs to be rehabilitated because, after all, as I've now shown, it was not her doing the chasing or the hunting. She was the hunted. And so, you know, it's about time that her reputation was rehabilitated, even if she is still not the most saintly person you'll ever meet. You know, she did her fair share of manipulation. She still deserves a second hearing.
What's next for you, Anne?
I don't know. I'm open to suggestions. She's really a hard act to follow. I'd love to write about another transatlantic strong woman, misunderstood.
I've got an idea.
Okay, tell me.
Well, I was reading in the book about Lady Cunard, and I guess she Lady Cunard also knew Pamela Harriman.
Yes.
And I guess Pamela Harriman first met Avril Harriman at a party that Lady Cunard gave, right?
Well, Pamela Harriman has been much written about. I agree, she's fascinating. You know, everybody has been written about. I would like to find somebody that, you know, people don't actually know the real story behind them. And perhaps there's more to say about Emerald Cunard. She is interesting, I agree. She's not exactly a household name. The thing about Wallace is that's so extraordinary is that everyone thinks they knew her story. Mm-hmm. And what's been so great is being able to show, well, hold on, you actually don't know her story. But, you know, if there's somebody you can come up with, I would love to know.
Yeah. I just thought Pamela Harriman would be a good book. I mean,
She is. But I think there are at least a couple of recent books out there, aren't there? I think.
Yeah, but they were written, I think, right after she died. And I read somewhere recently that Winston, her son, passed away recently. So I just,
yes.
You know. But anyway,
well,
I've really enjoyed this book a great deal, and congratulations on it. Continued good luck, and I've really enjoyed the conversation today.
Well, thank you for giving me the chance to talk about it, which is what I love.
You're very welcome. The website for more, anseba.com. The book is called That Woman, The Life of Wallace Simpson, Duchess of Windsor. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Its author, Anne Seba, on the line from Chicago. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.